Call to order this meeting of the Commerce Committee. We do have a quorum. Our first item of business is approval of our minutes from March 6, 2024. Representative Katisa Watune, would you like to make a motion?
Mr. Chair, I would move approval of the March 6 minutes.
Representative Katisa Watune moves approval of the March 6 minutes. Representative Niska.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson. There are two roll calls on amendments that I introduced that I believe I was the one who made the roll call or requested the roll call on those. So I would request that the minutes be amended in line with that. Thank you.
And for other members of the committee, we discussed this really briefly before coming into session, and Mr. Durfee has the corrections as to which roll calls were requested by Representative Niska. So the motion will be to approve the minutes as corrected by Representative Niska. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the minutes as corrected are adopted. The first bill on our agenda today is House File 4347 from Representative Norris. And I will move House File 4347 be re-referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. Representative Norris, to your bill.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson and members of the committee. It's great to be back before you. This House File 4347, relates to a bill that we passed last year. This is essentially doing some cleanup on the coerced debt bill from 2023. As we talked about at the time, 95% of abusive relationships involve financial abuse. And the bill that we passed last year was designed to protect the survivors of this financial abuse while helping creditors attempt to recover the coerced debt from the perpetrator of the abuse. And as a refresher, coerced debt involves situations like any of the following. An abuser stealing a survivor's identity and using it to incur debt, forcing a survivor to take on debt through the threat of force, intimidation, undue influence, fraud, deception, or coercion, or causing a survivor to go into debt by, for instance, prohibiting them from working. It was a great bill last year. It passed with bipartisan support. Mr. Elwood has done a great job in the interim of working with the various stakeholders on some cleanup to the bill, and that's what the bill before us today does. And I'll turn it over to Mr. Elwood to talk a little bit more about the exact contents of the bill.
Mr. Elwood returns to the committee for the first time this year, I think. Mr. Elwood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. Appreciate the opportunity to support this bill. I want to thank Representative Norris for carrying it last year and then carrying the cleanup this year. And I really want to thank the Minnesota Bankers Association and the Minnesota Credit Union Association and the collectors, the Great Lakes collectors, whatever their name is. And for working on this with us. They came to us over the Minnesota Bankers Association came to us over the interim. And as often happens here at the legislature, when you pass a bill and you look at it a little bit later on after it's codified, you see some issues that we overlooked. So this bill essentially cleans up a number of those kinds of things. For example, the term harassment was in the bill last year. It was pointed out that, of course, harassment only applies when there is not a domestic relationship, and therefore it doesn't belong in this bill. Some other provisions in here that make it clear that the coerced debt that would be relieved, that where the survivor would be relieved of that debt, would for sure be then transferred to the abuser, assuming there are the proper judicial procedural safeguards in place. And I'm happy to stand for any questions. Appreciate your support.
Are there any members of the public wishing to testify as to this bill? Seeing none, move discussion to the bill. Representative Norris, closing comments.
Appreciate the continued support for this. It's a really important issue and one that I'm glad we can continue to address.
I will renew my motion that House File 4347 be referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails, and House File 4347 is recommended to be referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. Thank you, Representative Norris. The next bill on our agenda today is House File 1989 from Representative Mohler. And while Representative Mohler is coming up, I will first note to everybody who's planning to testify on this bill and any other bills on the calendar today, we're doing 2 minutes per testifier. And I'm going to have to be really strict about that today. We have a packed agenda. So 2 minutes per testifier, and then I will ask people to conclude their testimony. Representative Mohler, I will move House File 1989 be placed on the General Register. I will further move the DE5 amendment And I will further move the A1 amendment, the DE5 amendment. Representative Mueller, do you want to describe the A1 amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The A1 amendment just provides some clarifying language that stakeholders requested around the disclosures portion of the bill.
Discussion to the A1. Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The A1 is adopted. Representative Mueller, if you want to discuss the DE5 amendment as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. It's nice to be back in front of you again with House File 1989. We did have a hearing on this bill last year. It was the first time it received a hearing. And at that point, we knew that there were a lot of stakeholders that still needed to be involved in the discussion. And so I did that work with Senator Klein over the interim. In fact, the number of hours that I've spent talking to stakeholders probably remarkably exceeds the number of minutes I've spent listening to all too well the 10-minute version, Taylor's version from the vault. So a lot of discussion has been had on this bill, and essentially what the DE does, it still has the same consumer protections that we heard last year, but it basically comes in three different categories. One is all-in pricing to make sure that consumers know upfront what the total cost of their ticket's going to be, not have to wait till the very end of the process to learn that amount. It bans speculative ticketing, and that is the process where tickets are sold before they're actually even available to anybody, to really cut down on some of the fraud that's involved. And then third, it prevents misleading practices, for example, like having websites that pop up that look like they belong to the venue or the whoever's selling the tickets, and they actually don't. And since we've heard this bill, I've heard from Minnesotans who have told me that that has actually happened to them, and they've been duped into buying tickets they didn't actually have because they were from these misleading sites. Finally, this bill has a provision in it that the Department of Commerce can request information about the use of bots. So that is really what it does in a nutshell. And I have one testifier.
Great. Before we get to the testifiers, we're going to adopt the DE5. Any discussion to the DE5? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. DE5 is adopted. We'll now take testimony starting, I believe, with Mike Dean.
Yes.
Mr. Dean. Representative Cleaborn.
I know we adopted the
A1, but is the DE5 Yes, and I thank you for that clarification. So the motion that I had was to adopt the DE5 as amended by the A1. The motion prevailed. The DE5 as amended is adopted. Mr. Dean, you may proceed.
Chair Stevenson, members of the committee, my name is Mike Dean. I am the executive director of North Star Prosperity. We seek to build an inclusive economy for all Minnesotans. I want to thank Representative Mueller for bringing forward this important legislation to protect consumers from junk fees. Those are the annoying service and convenience charges that get added to your cart at checkout. I became personally interested in this issue for the same reason the bill author. I was burned by deceptive practices on too many occasions. In fact, this past weekend, I brought my 12-year-old daughter to the Women's Big Ten basketball tournament to see the phenom Iowa basketball star Caitlin Clark. My daughter's unwavering love for women's basketball began just the age of 4 when I took her to a Lynx game. Since then, she's been captivated both as a spectator and as a player. Witnessing her dedication to the sport has been immensely fulfilling as a father. This is where she learns to challenge herself, set goals, and overcome obstacles. When she expressed a desire to attend the Big Ten tournament, I just couldn't refuse. I promptly went online to purchase tickets at $75 each, thinking she could even bring a friend along if she wished. But I wasn't done. Right before I hit purchase, they added a facility fee of $112, a handling fee of $6.18, and a service fee of $87.92. So those $300 tickets rose to $506.10. Right now, ticket vendors like Ticketmaster are permitted to levy these junk fees that don't correspond to any actual service or product. As consumers, we have no choice but to pay up. The practice of price gouging has persisted for years, driving ticket prices far beyond the advertised rates. It's bad for Minnesotans, and it's bad for small businesses. By mandating transparent pricing and requiring ticket vendors to disclose all fees up front, we can level this playing field and empower consumers to make informed decisions with their hard-earned money. All-in pricing boosts market competitiveness, making comparison shopping easier for consumers, and reduces the overall cost. Studies have shown that junk fees and drip pricing not only complicate comparison shopping, but also result in consumers paying significantly more for prices, often up to 21% more than the advertised price. Let's champion fairness and empower consumers in Minnesota by mandating transparent pricing, thereby promoting healthy competition and shielding consumers from these obnoxious fees.
And then I'll need you to wrap up your testimony.
Great. Last sentence. Together we can ensure that every Minnesotan has the opportunity to make informed choices with their hard-earned money.
Thank you. Next we have Todd Dusing, who will be followed by Robert Singleton. Mr. Dusing, come forward, state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Todd Dusing, president and CEO of the nonprofit operator and presenter, Hennepin Theater Trust. Thank you for allowing me to provide testimony in support of this Minnesota bill aimed at protecting consumers from unfair practices by ticket resellers. This legislation represents a critical step forward in safeguarding the rights and interests of Minnesotans in the realm of ticket purchasing. By supporting HF 1989, together we affirm and protect our belief in the intrinsic value of the arts and their power to elevate the human spirit, unite communities, and positively impact local economies. Ticket resellers, often operating in a largely unregulated market, have been known to engage in practices that harm consumers, including exorbitant markups, hidden fees, and deceptive advertising. These bad actors dupe the consumer by manipulating the online marketplace to represent themselves as the official ticket source or falsely represent that they have ownership of the most desirable tickets, when in fact they do not. These practices not only exploit unsuspecting consumers, but also undermine the integrity of the attendee experience. By implementing measures to regulate ticket resellers and ensure transparency and fairness in ticket transactions, this bill seeks to level the playing field and empower consumers to make informed choices. It aims to curb predatory pricing practices and establish mechanisms for recourse in cases of fraud or misrepresentation. The nonprofit arts and entertainment presenter will no longer have to be beholden to remedy a bad actor's dishonesty to preserve its reputation and relationship with event goers. Furthermore, this legislation aligns with Minnesota's commitment to promoting consumer rights and fostering a marketplace that operates with integrity and accountability. It sends a clear message that the interests of our consumers will not be overlooked or sacrificed in the pursuit of profit.
And if you could wrap up your testimony.
Sure. Please. I commend the legislators who have championed this bill and their dedication for standing up for consumers across our state. I'd like to particularly recognize Representative Kelly Moeller. Her leadership underscores the importance of enacting meaningful protections for all Minnesotans. I'd also like to acknowledge the bicameral partnership of these policies between the representative and her Senate counterpart, Matt Klein. Thank you for the time.
All right. Then we have Robert Singleton. Mr. Singleton, please come forward, state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Chair Stevenson, members of the committee. My name is Robert Singleton. I'm the Director of Policy and Public Affairs for State Advocacy for Chamber of Progress. We are a tech industry coalition promoting technology's progressive future. Our members include companies like StubHub, and Vivid Seats, but they do not have a voter veto over our positions. I'm urging you to revise HF 1989, which would, as written, hurt consumers and benefit dominant ticket-selling companies like Ticketmaster. Some online ticket marketplaces like Ticketmaster and its parent company, Live Nation, enjoy a unique position as the event presenter, original ticket seller, and reseller, a role that puts them in a position similar to competing ticket resellers. Consequently, these multi-role marketplaces expose consumers to comparable challenges and issues encountered by the resale competitors, a situation that has garnered significant attention and even prompted scrutiny from the Department of Justice. HF 1989 prohibits the sale of speculative tickets. In the dynamic and fiercely competitive online ticketing industry, consumers benefit greatly from a wide array of resale options. This is advantageous for consumers who may not have the ideal circumstances to purchase tickets within limited time frames offered by original ticket sellers. Consequently, the online ticket resale market has emerged as a vital platform catering to a much broader consumer base than incumbent sellers. Limiting access to these secondary markets could stifle innovation in the ticketing marketplace that creates better options for consumers, such as ticketing procurement services that allow consumers to avoid the primary sale process. Furthermore, HF 1999 limits ticket holders from reselling their ticket before the primary ticket seller's public sale process, whether or not the ticket is speculative. Rather than an outright ban, we would encourage the bill to require additional disclosure of speculative ticket sales. HF 1989 does include extensive language promoting disclosure, and we support this goal and appreciate your attention to empowering consumers. In this regard, the best practices for all-in pricing disclosure is to make the total price visible from beginning to end with an itemized breakdown available at the end. And we support this and support the amendment. However, the outright ban on speculative ticket sales might hurt and limit innovation in other contexts. So accordingly,
your testimony, please.
We are not able to support HF 1989 at this time and encourage you to continue revising the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any members of the public wishing to testify as to this bill? Seeing none, discussion to the bill. Representative Niska.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Mueller, I just wanted to, this is kind of retreading some ground that you and I covered in commerce, but or in judiciary, but the bill as it's written talks about enforcement by the Department of, or by the Commissioner of Commerce, but I just wanted to make clear that your intent of the bill and your understanding of the bill is that it also would fall within the provisions of Section 8.31 and giving rise to separate Attorney General enforcement with also a potential private right of action if the requirements of 8.31 are also met. I just wanted to get that on the record if I'm understanding that correctly.
Chair Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Niska, yes, that is correct. It is intended for 8.31 action by the Attorney General, which also creates a private right of action in judiciary. We talked about a recent case law from the Minnesota Supreme Court that allows for that interpretation. I'll also note that a fiscal note's been requested here. One was prepared in the Senate, and the Attorney General's office did put a small fiscal note on this because of that anticipated involvement that they could have with us.
Representative Niska.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Mueller. Thank you. I appreciate the clarity on that. I think this is probably one of those cases, those situations where that is a reasonable way to enforce this law when we're dealing with large-scale events like this. There's probably something that's important for the Attorney General to take a look at potentially, and even potentially, a public benefit to a private case if necessary. But I just wanted to make sure that the record was completely clear about that, so I appreciate that.
And if we also clarify, Mr. Mueller, the bill doesn't appropriate money to the Attorney General, and I think the idea is that the Attorney General is going to absorb the cost. Is the bill's position, which is why we're referring it to the General Register and not Ways and Means or the State Government Committee. Is that accurate?
Yes, that's correct, Mr. Chair. We're still working through that with this, with Senator Klein and the Attorney General, but it is a very small note, and that would be our intent.
Chair Cleaborne.
And this is under, Mr. Chair. And this is under existing statute of 8.31. It's not an expansion, is that correct?
Chair Mueller.
That's correct.
Thank you very much.
Closing comments, Chair Mueller.
That is it. We don't have any lyrics going on. You all are not as much fun as the Judiciary Committee, but maybe everybody's worn out from that those song lyrics. Anyway, I really appreciate the opportunity to present this and look forward to your vote in support.
All right. No further discussion. All those I will renew my motion that House File 1989, as amended, be placed on the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. House File 1989, as amended, is recommended be placed on the General Register. And Chair Mueller, you can stay right where you are because the next bill on the agenda is House File 1791. I will move House File 1791 also be placed on the General Register. And I will also move the A3 amendment. Representative Mueller, if you could describe the A3.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The A3 amendment is based on stakeholder feedback that our language covered more insurance products than we intended it to cover last time. And so we are narrowing it to cover just long-term care, long-term disability, which is the intent of our bill.
Okay. Any discussion to the A3? Seeing no discussion, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and the A3 is adopted. Representative Mueller, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So I started learning about the issues related to long-term care and long-term disability insurance when I was first elected. In fact, a constituent reached out to me about this issue in 2019 about not getting the benefits that they paid for with their long-term care insurance. I was able to connect with an attorney, Elizabeth Rogel, who I worked with years ago, and I actually learned that this problem was not unique to my constituent. It is something that many Minnesotans have experienced, a lack of remedy for claims that were denied in bad faith. My testifiers will provide more information about how this bill works, but please look at the packet of letters describing how hardworking Minnesotans paid tens of thousands of dollars for long-term care, long-term disability plans. These Minnesotans expected the insurance companies to hold up their end of the bargain if a valid claim was made. What you will see in the letters and from our testifier today is that vulnerable people, often elderly people with dementia or Alzheimer's, are denied by their long-term care insurance plans when a valid claim is made and care is needed. For those who have family members to help them, those family members are spending countless hours getting the runaround from these insurance companies. The victims are spending exorbitant out-of-pocket expenditures for coverage that they paid these companies for but were ignored or denied. We did press pause on this. This bill's been around for a couple of years. The insurance companies asked us to get data We got it. Between June 18 of 2018 and October of 2023, there were 264 complaints to Commerce about these products. Next, we were told that our bill was too broad and covered other insurance products that we didn't intend to cover. That's why we brought the amendment today. We cannot delay any longer to make sure that these Minnesotans get the coverage that they paid for and deserve. Thank you.
All right. We'll now move to testimony. As a reminder, we're tight today, so I need everyone to stick for 2 minutes. I know this is a difficult subject, but I need everyone to stick to 2 minutes today. Our first testifier is Elizabeth Roble. I hope I got your name correct. Nope.
It's the other. Sorry.
This is Lynn Cox?
Yes.
All right. Ms. Cox.
Good afternoon. My name is Lynn Cox. My husband, who died of Alzheimer's disease this past August, and I were both public school teachers, and we purchased our long-term care insurance through our union in 2002. The original policy was Bankers United, which was later taken over by Transamerica. His memory loss progressed over many years with diagnosis and support by a neuro-OT, a neuropsychologist, and a neurologist. Services for his care began with adult day programs that closed with COVID, and then home health care. All was approved by Transamerica, including their hired evaluator sent to our home. I submitted an endless cycle of licensing and billing information to Transamerica by certified mail and are having the provider's fax dates of service and billings. Their EOBs were confusing and no payments were made, even though they had approved the providers and elimination periods had been met. Phone calls to their 1-800 number were forwarded to various departments, such as claims and benefits, which took up to 90 minutes, and then they dropped the call. When he began services in memory care residence, premiums should have been waived after a specific number of days, but Transamerica kept taking his premiums, auto pay, until he died. Without payments, I was forced to hire an attorney, and eventually payments began trickling in until the huge amount of repayment was eliminated to near $2,000. In the midst of this process, Transamerica sent notices of offering to buy out his policy for a very small amount, which was less than 1.5 months of residential costs. How Transamerica handles its business is awful. No spouse or family member should have to spend the final days with their loved ones in a battle for insurance coverage after paying over two decades of premiums. I've spoken with many who have had bad, challenging experiences with long-term care insurance claims. These very vulnerable people have often just given up what is rightfully deserved insurance claims. They are not denied. They're just not paid. Thank you for your support to House Bill number 1791.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Elizabeth Rowell. Come forward, state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon. My name is Elizabeth Roble. I practice law in St. Paul, and I handle long-term care insurance disputes for policyholders. I handled my first LTCI dispute in 2012. I had only been in private practice a few years after working in public sector for well over a decade. Among other things, I prosecuted crimes against vulnerable adults and white-collar fraud schemes against Medicaid. My first client was Helen. She had severe dementia. Due to family history, Helen's husband insisted she purchase long-term care insurance. He knew he'd probably decease her, which he did. He knew she'd probably develop dementia, which she did. Helen paid premiums for over 20 years when she moved into assisted living. Her daughter, Marilyn, attempted to assist with claims, but by the time I was hired, they had been engaged with the insurance company for months. Despite countless phone calls, being provided with inconsistent and erroneous answers to her coverage questions, and providing the company with every single document they requested, the denials continued. It was a moving target. When I took on the internal appeal, I attacked it like a trial lawyer, and I offered all the evidence I could think of to demonstrate Helen's need to satisfy the policy terms, including a videotape of Helen. With my significant effort, the company finally paid. Since Helen, I've represented dozens and dozens of policyholders in these types of disputes. The facts may vary, the company's names may differ, but the egregious claims handling is the same. Ignoring plain policy language, ignoring clear medical evidence, repeated requests for nursing assessment, differing bases for denial, and the most agonizing delay. Over the last several years, I made data requests to the Department of Commerce. I wanted to see if they were getting the same complaints. In total, I've received 264 redacted complaints.
And I need you to wrap up your testimony.
Yes. Over the last 5 years, we created an index, and what we saw was consistent with what my clients were enduring. Few policyholders have the financial, physical, and emotional wherewithal to challenge insurance companies, let alone hire an attorney to handle it on their behalf. These practices are unacceptable and can no longer go unchecked, and a legal remedy must be addressed, which is what we are asking for in this amendment.
Thank you. Last, we have Kate McKinnon. Not here.
She was unable to make it.
Okay. Any members of the public wishing to testify? I'm sorry, Robin Rowan is next. There's a gap on my page here, and I just went right past it.
Are you saying there was a blank space there? And you wrote my name.
We almost got there.
Sorry, that doesn't count to my
I'll
2 minutes,
I'll still let you testify.
Right? Yeah, please, Ms. don't Rowan. Count that. Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Robin Rowan. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Insurance Financial Services Council. Thank you for the opportunity to express our concerns with House File 1791. Insurance companies absolutely need to keep their promises, and the vast majority do. When claims disputes do occur, consumers need a swift resolution, and we do not think more litigation is the answer here. Allowing a court to award attorney's fees and non-economic damages in a breach of contract suit will expose every long-term care and disability policy to an additional $350,000 in costs beyond the policy limits, increased litigation, and nuisance lawsuits, all of which will increase the premiums for these products, products which the state actually encourages individuals to buy to reduce the number of Minnesotans on MA, medical assistance. The DOC's As I said, the vast majority of insurers keep their promises. If they don't, the Department of Commerce does a very thorough job of enforcing the Unfair Claim Practices Act, which prohibits insurers from unreasonably denying or delaying claims. In fact, most of the facts that I heard today would have violated that act. The DOC's ability to suspend an insurer's license, impose significant fines, and the resulting bad publicity function as significant deterrents. In addition, the DOC's vigorous enforcement efforts can and do result in proceeds being awarded to claimants. In just one example, the Department of Commerce ordered a life insurer to return $13 million to beneficiaries. The proponent's own research calls the need for more litigation into question. In the past 5 years, there have been approximately 50 complaints per year, which translates into a complaint ratio of 0.0025%. I run from math, but that's a pretty small number. Further, almost half of those complaints concern just one insurer, and the DOC initiated a significant enforcement action against that insurer, including fines and a corrective action plan. The remaining complaints are spread over 28 different insurers, with each averaging approximately one complaint per year.
And I'll need you to wrap up your testimony.
Absolutely. So increased litigation is not the answer, especially when you have consumers that are in nursing homes and in assisted living. They need a swift response. And we think an expedited claims process at the Department of Commerce would solve that problem without increasing premiums. Thank you.
Thank you. Now I'll ask, are there any members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we'll move to amendments. Representative O'Driscoll, you have the DE1 amendment. Members, the DE1 amendment you will find in your folder for House File 4396. It just was misplaced in your packets, but you have it in the packet for 4396. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What the DE1 amendment to House File 1791 endeavors to do is instead of jumping to a litigation step, it broadens the scope and the tools that the Minnesota Department of Commerce has. And it allows for a more robust opportunity for person to file a claim, to work with the insurance company, to keep the department in the loop on what's happening, and actually compels, once the department is involved, to strike a settlement and an answer to the open questions and to the insurance concerns within 60 days. And so if we have a shortcoming in the process, I'd like to give the regulators more authority to be able to enforce the law and tools if necessary before we jump to a litigation step. And so that is the gist of what the DE amendment does, Mr. Chair.
Chair Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And while I appreciate the amendment, I'm going to recommend that members vote no on this amendment. It doesn't cover long-term disability. That's the first problem. Our bill is getting at both long-term care and long-term disability. The department already does have this enforcement authority, and as we heard from our testifiers, from the data we've gotten, in spite of getting penalties, it hasn't stopped the bad behavior, so we've already gone down that route. It also would likely have a fiscal note attached to it. I don't know that any request has been made of that, but I would assume that that would cause the process that you have in your DE would cause the department to spend more money on this. And again, like I said, we've already logged complaints and we haven't seen any behavior change by these insurance companies.
Discussion to the amendment. Representative Justin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the issue of the fiscal note, it would be nearly impossible for us to have a fiscal note produced at this time, given the fact that this was posted just a few days ago and over the weekend for staff to be able to do that. I am happy to lay the entertain laying the bill on the DE amendment over until we have a fiscal note to be able to look at if that provides help in the decision process and the discernment about what might be the best remedy.
Further discussion. Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
The motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. Discussion to the bill. Closing comments, Chair Moore. Representative O'Driscoll.
I mean, I just literally put my page down here on the other stuff
to the
new business.
This time.
Mr. Chair, I'm wondering if Peter Brickwitty, who is here today from the department, could get down a couple of questions for him today.
Mr. Brickwitty, are you looking for you all the way back there? Maybe you can pose your question as he's walking down. Representative Driscoll.
Thank you. Mr. Brickwitty, is this something that the department has asked for? And maybe you can speak to the conversation we had on the DE amendment. You and I did, in the way of full disclosure, have some offline conversations about does the department need additional resources and things to be able to do it. I attempted something today. I'm just curious to see what the department can shed for light on this before we take action on this bill today. Thank you, Mr. Brickwitty.
Mr. Brickwitty.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Peter Brickwitty, Assistant Commissioner at the Commerce Department. This was not a department initiative, and the department will never say no if the legislature wants to provide more resources to the Commerce Department.
Representative Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Brickwitty, I appreciate that. My question is, do you feel that the department needs additional resources and tools in which to be able to do the job of enforcement in the DI and or other legislation, or excuse me, other insurance contracts?
Mr. Brickwitty.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, and my apologies, I was being a little bit glib with you initially there. I think this is a very difficult market. And I think we do, as you have heard from testifiers, receive a number of complaints about this industry. I think constituent services in both caucuses are very familiar with this topic, and it is something that is not unique to Minnesota. So I think at a high level, the general premise of enforcement in this area is trying to make the best of a bad situation for everybody. We are responsible for approving rates and forms in the state of Minnesota. I think we have actually some of the nation's leading expertise in this space on the regulatory side. I think, and I would agree with Ms. Rowan, many of the things that we've heard about in testimony today and we saw in the written testimony are complaints that I think we would want to hear about at the Commerce Department. With more resources, could we look at them more expeditiously or faster? Certainly so, but I don't think there's anything necessarily in the DE amendment that would change the scope of our regulatory practice. I think, as I'm reading it for the first time, I think it would change the time frames in which we would conduct investigations, which I would agree with Representative Mueller. We would likely need financial resources to be able to do that in the way the amendment is set. But I think we do want consumers to be able to have options. We want them to understand what those options are in the face of increasing premiums in this market. But without increasing premiums in certain cases, some companies may have solvency concerns, which is also not good for consumers.
can give you one more follow-up.
Yep, and I was just going to say, I don't have a question. I just have a kind of a summation on my thoughts on this. I put this together, this amendment, because we were looking at maybe the department not having that to get a conversation today. I appreciate Mr. Berkowitz's testimony today. But I will remind the committee that when we do engage in litigation, it costs the insurance company money. That money comes out of the pool of dollars that they collect in premiums that will be used to pay benefits to individuals. And so there's a way that we can work with the department and work with regulators to get this done at a more expedient fashion and at a cheaper rate, I think that serves policyholders and insureds in the best light. So, Mr. Chair, I would strongly encourage, never mind, I will save my comments. I'm not in favor of the bill as written.
Chair Mueller, closing comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I certainly appreciate this discussion today, but just a reminder that the litigation that would be allowed through this is for bad faith denials by these insurance companies of these claims. I think that's important to keep in mind. It's also important to keep in mind that the consumer needs a recourse, and while the department can enforce some of these things, we've seen where they've actually penalized these companies, the companies have continued the bad behavior. So this has been tried. It's not been successful. The problem continues. I agree with Ms. Rowan when she said consumers need a swift response. They do, and they're not getting it from these insurance companies. And for all those reasons, I would ask the committee to vote yes on this bill. Thank you.
I will renew my motion that House File 1791, as amended, be placed on the general register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
No. Motion prevails, and House File 1791, as amended, is recommended to be placed on the general register. Thank you, Chair Mueller. The next item on our agenda is House File 3438 from Representative Greenman. I will move House File 3438 be placed on the general register. I will also move the DE1 amendment. We do have a little bit of an unusual posture here, so bear with me. We are going to next move the A1 amendment to the DE1 amendment. And before we take that up, we are going to move an oral amendment to the A1 amendment. Ms. Pompeo, could you please describe the oral amendment?
Sure. Chair and members, we're looking at H3438A1 on line 1.1 after House File number 3438. Insert the language, the delete everything amendment, parentheses, H3438DE1, end parentheses. And then on line 1.2, delete line 21 and insert line 16.
So members, this is to just clarify that the A1 is an amendment to the DE. Is there any discussion to the oral amendment? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and the oral amendment is adopted. We're now going to act on the amended A1 amendment. Representative Greenman, can you describe the A1 amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Think that
this is Representative Kraft, apparently. Representative Kraft, I moved your A1 amendment for you. I'm sorry. That's my mistake. But if you could describe your A1 amendment.
I appreciate you moving it, Chair. Yeah, so the A1 just deals with a situation where a food service establishment may want to incorporate automatic tips, which I've seen some do, into the price of food service.
Discussion to the A1. Seeing none, all those in favor of adopting the A1 amendment as amended by the oral amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the A1 amendment as amended is adopted. We'll now take up the DE1 amendment. Representative Greenman, could you describe the DE1 amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And would you like me to save sort of the description of this, or do you want me to do this now? This is a DE that sort of reflects a lot of the work that's been happening since we originally introduced the bill, and I can either do the explanation now or wait until
we. Why don't we adopt the DE, and then I'll give you a chance to describe the bill.
Okay.
Any discussion to the DE1 amendment as amended? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails, and the DE1 amendment as amended is adopted. Representative Greenman, to your bill as amended.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I promise that is the most complicated thing we'll do today. This is a relatively simple bill. I'm glad to be back in commerce. It's a bill that ends the practice of junk fees by requiring upfront disclosure of the full cost of goods and services. Protects consumers from hidden fees and deceptive pricing, and also promotes a fairer market, providing price transparency and competition. Not sure what a junk fee is, and it's not just Ticketmaster. I think you have the Ticketmaster bill up. But think about the last time you bought an airplane ticket online, a hotel room, tickets for the twins, a new phone. When you looked at the price, did it look close to what you saw at the market advertised rate? Think about the last time you went out for dinner or ordered online and you saw a fee, a convenience fee, a service fee, a wellness fee that you weren't quite sure what that was for. These junk fees have become impossible to avoid and leave consumers frustrated, confused, and importantly, unable to comparison shop to find the right deal for the right price. They're driving up prices for Minnesotans. On average, households spend over $3,000 annually for junk fees that artificially inflate prices without offering any tangible benefits. This bill ends that practice by adding a subdivision to the Deceptive Practices Act, requiring that any mandatory fee or surcharge that's to be included, that has to be included in the advertised or list price for the goods or services. Fees that can't be avoided paying must be baked into the advertised or price for any good. The bill, as amended, includes additional language that we've been working on. We've been, Senator Port and I have been talking to a lot of folks impacted by this. It allows for the actual cost of postage and shipping to be calculated and listed separately. It allows for auctions that may sort of run on that model, and it protects the ability of folks to discount their products from that list price. Folks are being nickel and dimed by these extra fees, and this bill is an attempt to end that and create price transparency in the market. With that, Mr. Chair, I believe we have a few testifiers.
We do, and as a reminder, we're limiting all testimony today to 2 minutes. Representative Greenman, if you would be so kind as to sit at the table just during this, that way we can have two testifiers at the table at a time. So I'm going to call up two testifiers at a time. Okay. And just both come up, and we'll go one at a time. We'll do that. So if Tyro Devolites and Matt Kelleher could both come down, and we'll start with Mr. Devolites. State your name for the record. Proceed to your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Tyro Devolites, and I'm the Vice President of LEADAMEN, an organization that advocates on the behalf of 100,000 community and technical colleges students here in Minnesota. I currently attend Normandale Community College in Bloomington. I'm here today to discuss the unnecessary burden that junk fees put on community college students like myself. When I was young, my parents got divorced, and my life was very hectic. Like a lot of young people, I was struggling to find my place in the world. During this time, I found solace in music, specifically an indie rock band called Mother Mother. On my way home from working at the pizza shop that I part-time worked at, I learned they were coming to Minneapolis, and I couldn't believe it. I knew I had to see them. By this point in my life, I was financially independent. I worked hard to pay my bills and monthly expenses, working part-time while carrying a full course load. Tickets to the concert were advertised as $100, and it was steep, and it used all my social budget for the month, but it was worth it. I went to purchase the tickets, and by the end of the transaction, the $100 tickets were closer to $200 because of the additional fees, surcharges, and taxes. I do not make enough money that an extra $100 charge would go unnoticed. I flipped over every couch cushion, searched every pocket, used all the tips I earned at the pizza shop to afford that ticket. And it's not just concert tickets. Corporations are adding these extra fees everywhere. Every month, my phone bill has a random fees and charges beyond the expected data and usage fees. 50 cents here, a few dollars there. It doesn't sound like a lot, but to a lot of Minnesotans, these little fees add up. In fact, the average family pays approximately $3,000 in junk fees every year. It's not right that if a consumer wants to do research and compare real prices versus advertised prices, it can take hours, even days. It's not right that corporations are ripping us off, getting rich off the backs of community college students, families, and hardworking Minnesotans. Members of the committee, I urge you to pass HF3438 by requiring an all-in pricing transparency. You would be empowering consumers to make the right choices for themselves and their families. We would know the actual price of the project and be able to budget accordingly. And you'd be checking the power of corporations who have been taking advantage of Minnesotans for far too long. Thank you.
Thank you for that testimony. Mr. Kelleher. And then we follow by Scott Lambert. So, Mr. Lambert, if you could come down. Mr. Kelleher.
Chair Stevenson, members of the committee, my name is Matt Kelleher, and I am a St. Paul resident and a state and local policy specialist at the American Economic Liberties Project, a research and advocacy organization dedicated to reducing the power corporations wield over our economy and our democracy. I am here today to voice my strong support for HF 3438, the proposed legislation to ban junk fees in Minnesota. Hidden and deceptive fees have become pervasive in a variety of industries. We've all seen them on live event tickets. I know I've paid many junk fees to see the Timberwolves play. But they're also levied on hotel reservations, cable and phone bills, rental housing, storage unit, food delivery services, and more. These fees are tacked on near the end of transactions without consumers' prior knowledge nor consent, drastically altering the final price of a product or service from the price that was initially advertised. Research has shown that junk fees raise prices by as much as 20% and cost the average American family more than $3,000 per year. Last week at the State of the Union, the President stated that his administration is eliminating billions in junk fees. And state legislators have a vital role to play to support that work and to ensure that Minnesota can enforce these rules against junk fees within our own state. By passing this legislation, you guarantee that Minnesotans have access to transparent pricing, allowing them to make informed decisions about their purchases through honest comparison shopping. Moreover, it sends a clear message to corporations that these deceptive pricing practices will not be tolerated in Minnesota. All-in pricing promotes healthy competition among businesses. Local businesses with transparent pricing shouldn't be harmed by appearing artificially more expensive than big corporations that rely on hidden fees. To be clear, this legislation only covers mandatory fees that consumers cannot avoid. It does not tell businesses what prices they can charge, and it does not prevent the use of optional add-ons that consumers affirmatively choose. It simply says that if a fee must be paid in order to complete the transaction, that fee must be disclosed upfront so consumers know the actual price they are agreeing to pay.
I need you to wrap up your testimony.
Last two lines. The public overwhelmingly supports this legislation. 86% of Minnesotans support it, including 93% of Democrats, 87% of Independents, and 78% of Republicans. So I urge you to support Representative Greenman's bill to ban junk fees in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Scott Lambert, who will be followed by Jacob Windling. Mr. Windling, if you could come down to the dais, Mr. Lambert.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Scott Lambert, and I'm president of the Minnesota Automobile Dealers Association. Let me be clear, Mr. Chairman, that there are fees attached to the purchase of a motor vehicle. Everything is disclosed during the course of the sale, but a vehicle purchase is not simple, quick, or an impulse item. Important items are disclosed when it is timely to do so. During the course of purchasing a $50,000 vehicle, a customer may be given the opportunity to spend $30 to expedite plates and titles. It may or may not be considered mandatory depending on the consumer's circumstances, but that fact will make it problematic under this bill for the dealer, who will have to disclose such a fee regardless of whether or not the customer is going to take advantage of it. Mr. Chairman, let me also point out that this statute, the Deceptive Trade Practice Statute, and two other statutes under false statements and unlawful practices, 325 F67 and 69, have been used for years by the Minnesota Attorney General to very strong effect to enforce Minnesota's advertising laws, and has worked very well. This legislation, in our view, is a big departure from that tradition, providing a prohibition against a specific act, and does so in a very broad way. And finally, Mr. Chairman, in the interest of time, it is the third standard that is on, at least on my amendment, on 1.18, that prohibits a mandatory fee that a reasonable customer would expect to be included in the purchase of the goods or services being advertised. I'm not really sure what that means, Mr. Chairman, and I'm not sure what guidance we would give our dealers to ensure that they didn't trip over it. I'm very proud of our dealers and their advertising standards that they abide by. And I think this legislation needs a little bit more work. I'm happy to stand for any questions, and I look forward to working with the author as well.
Thank you, Mr. Lambert. Next, we have Jacob Windling, who will be followed by Sarah Psig. Mr. Windling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jacob Windling, and I'm a St. Paul resident.
In my view, this bill is not complicated, and I'm happy to speak in strong support of it. Minnesota consumers deserve to be plainly told a business's price for a product or service, not an arbitrary intermediate value that in that business's final computation of its going rate. As a recent example to illustrate this problem, a Duluth-based restaurant chain has used the following language on their menus that many of you may be broadly familiar with. A 5% kitchen team service charge will be added to all food purchases. Consequently, the price of the seasoned fries on this menu, $7.55, is not the price at all, but one step in a math problem to determine the restaurant's going rate of $7.93 that appears nowhere on the menu. This is not the way things need to be. There's been discussion already today about various other industries in which this is problematic. Surprisingly to me, car rental in, agencies do not have this problem. I recently needed to rent a car and was surprised to see that the final price, inclusive of all the many fees that these companies are required to charge, were included at every step in the process. The price I saw at the beginning of the scheduling and the price I saw on the final bill and what I was charged on my credit card were identical. The rental car agency, nevertheless, gave a breakdown of these fees. And the owner of this Duluth-based restaurant chain I mentioned spoke to the press recently in opposition to this bill, stating, quote, that this legislation would make bills less transparent because diners will see higher prices with no indication of where the money is going. A simple modification to the language would suffice, I believe. A 5% kitchen team service charge has been added to all food prices.
And if you could wrap up your testimony.
Thank you. I'm keenly aware that Minnesota businesses are struggling in this economic environment, but deceiving customers with price items on the menu with service fees tacked on that they simply cannot avoid but are not represented in the price on the menu or on other services and fees for products that they purchase cannot possibly be the solution. It's the opposite of transparency, and this bill puts an end to that practice. I strongly support it, and thank you for your time.
Thank you. Next is Sarah Pasek, who will be followed by Beth Cadoon. Ms. Pasek.
Hi. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and Representative Greenman. My name is Sarah Pasek. I'm here with CTIA, the Wireless Association. I want to thank Representative Greenman for our many conversations on the bill. However, the amendment today does not fully address our concerns, so I'm speaking in opposition, but look forward to continuing to work with you. We appreciate the goal of protecting consumers from practices that may undermine a consumer's ability to make informed commercial decisions. And our industry is committed to ensuring consumers have accurate and transparent information. However, robust federal regulations and public industry commitments already exist. The wireless industry is regulated by the FCC, which has its own regulatory regime to protect consumers from surprise or unfair fees and billing practices, including the broadband consumer labeling and truth in billing regulations. The FCC's rules already require the wireless industry to convey relevant information to consumers to effectively prevent and hold wireless providers responsible for unfair or deceptive fees. Importantly, in adopting this direction, Congress clearly intended the FCC to regulate advertising of broadband on a national level. A state-specific approach to regulating this industry could create additional consumer confusion with the potential for different pricing requirements in different states, especially since advertising medium often span across state lines. In a competitive marketplace, wireless carriers are incentivized to ensure consumers have the information they need to make commercial decisions. We want to avoid a patchwork of state-by-state regulations for services that are offered and regulated on a nationwide basis. So CTIA respectfully requests that if you intend to move this bill along, we ask that states limit the laws to industries that don't have the same robust federal oversight, and that's been done in Pennsylvania and Connecticut. So thank you again for the opportunity to talk today.
Thank you. Next is Beth Cadoon, who will be followed by Jill Sims. Ms. Cadoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Beth Cadoon. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. The Minnesota Chamber of Commerce does support the goal of price transparency. We thank Representative Greenman for her amendment and working with industries who had concerns on this bill. And this amendment does add some clarification. As this was just posted, we certainly still need time for businesses to be able to review this. We do remain concerned over the implementation of this new law and the potential inconsistencies and conflicts with the new federal regulation currently being proposed by the Federal Trade Commission on this very same subject. The FTC commenced rulemaking in November of 2023 on a rule entitled Rule on Unfair or Deceptive Fees, which would prohibit unfair or deceptive practices relating to fees for goods or services. The comment period of January was extended by 1 month to February 7th, 2024, due to the thousands of comments that they received from both consumers and in industries regarding the implementation and impacts of this new rule. The details of what price disclosure means in practice can be more complicated to actually determine what must be included in the price without running afoul of the statute and potential litigation. For example, the FTC uses different terms, such as total price, and then provides more details to define those. And then the FTC has also said they will exempt industries already covered by other disclosure laws, so similar to what our last testifier mentioned. We strongly recommend waiting until the FTC rule is finalized before enacting this law change in order to minimize any conflicts between state and federal law and minimize confusion for both industry and consumer. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Jill Sims.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson. Good afternoon, members. My name is Jill Sims, and I'm the Director of Government Relations at Hospitality Minnesota. We appreciate the opportunity to weigh in on House File 3438. First and foremost, thank you to the author, Representative Greenman, for her willingness to continually meet with us and discuss and understand the impacts of this language, as well as for the A1 amendment. Hospitality encompasses a variety of business models, of which many will be impacted by this bill. As this legislation moves forward, we ask that there is greater clarity as to who and what is impacted by the bill. With simultaneous movement on junk fees through the Federal Trade Commission, it is important our industry fully understands their options and has time to implement any changes. Currently in Minnesota, there are options for hospitality businesses to impose certain fees as long as they are properly disclosed on menus and receipts. While not all businesses choose to utilize these fees, it is an important tool for some of our businesses. For perspective, restaurant operators have been using fees and surcharges related to diners' added value or added services for decades. Diners have come to expect them in many experiences like large groups, delivery, and when using a credit card. Providing guidance and implementation time to Minnesota restaurants should their current models change is imperative. For our hotel industry, we support the federal standard that ensures a fair competitive playing field. Our own Senator, Senator Klobuchar, has introduced the No Hidden Fees Act, which mandates all in pricing display for anyone offering rates for short-term lodging. We believe price transparency is important for all lodging bookings, and we hope to see parity across platforms like hotel websites, online travel agencies, meta search sites, and short-term rentals. Finally, we look forward to continuing to work with the authors on the language around ensuring quasi-government fees like tourism improvement districts are exempted from this language. We greatly appreciate the time to weigh in and provide considerations for the dialogue going forward. Thank you, Representative Greenman, for your willingness to work with us. Thanks.
Thank you. Are there any members of the public wishing to testify as to this bill? Seeing none, member discussion to the bill. Representative O'Driscoll. Well, Representative Niska.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Greenman, I appreciate a lot of where this is coming from. I do think that there are some pretty significant implementation issues when we're drawing this broadly, and I would like to give you an opportunity to explain a little bit about what reasonably avoidable by the consumer and what a reasonable person would expect, what those provisions are trying to get at in the bill.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Niska. And this is as you mentioned, it cuts across. It is a broad rule on purpose because what we have heard is that it is important for instance, online hotel prices and what we're actually doing in hotels to be under the same rule. So that I just wanted to appreciate you sort of pointing that out. The reason this. B3 is here, and it sort of mirrors the FTC standard for deceptive practices because what it is about is the first two are very clear, but what we know in this area is that there's lots of creativity. There is we can't plan in a statute for everything that'll come in the future. I think if people had asked 10 years or 15 years ago what these practices would look like, we wouldn't have been able to legislate. So that is using the reasonable person standard that we see a lot in our judicial code, that would allow a judge to conclude if something, if a reasonable person thinks it's a junk fee, then it is.
Representative Niska.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate that answer. And I think it's important that everyone picks out one very important word in what you said, which is a judge. And the reason I think that's problematic in this bill in this way is that we're talking about a pretty comprehensive set of changes in the law to a bunch of different businesses, to a bunch of different in a bunch of different ways. And what we're telling everyone who is going to be affected by this law is you're going to have to wait 2, 3, 4, 5 years down the road to actually find out what this bill actually means in practice. And so that's why I think industry, so many different industries are so concerned about what are they supposed to tell the businesses about how to do it. And that's particularly problematic when we're talking about amendment to the Deceptive Trade Practices law in Minnesota, because the Deceptive Trade Practices law is not a law that where we primarily have some government actor like the Attorney General or someone else who is looking at the big picture. We have instead a very, very broad and robust and frankly incentivized system towards private litigation. It's a you don't have to be harmed in order to seek an injunction. You don't have to actually suffer any damages. You simply have to have a lawyer who helps you find a violation. In this case, a violation is an advertisement or display of something. The attorney gets attorney's fees. And as you, Chair Stevenson, as you mentioned in a discussion about a private right of action in other cases, bad cases make bad law. And so what we're going to be doing is creating this huge rule that applies broadly to many, many industries that we don't anticipate, we frankly can't anticipate all of the possible applications of it in this bill. We're telling the plaintiff's bar, and this is great for the plaintiff's bar, we're telling the plaintiff's bar, go forth and multiply the litigation in court cases, and then eventually down the road, some judges are going to tell us in those cases what the actual law is that people have to abide by probably 3 or 4 or 5 years from now. So that's just not the right way to regulate in this space. It doesn't really fit within the Deceptive Trade Practices Law, which is really about individual, one-off transactions or things, you know, a store runs a deceptive sale or something like that, where, individual people or a small group of people were injured. This is about broadly, what is an entire industry doing in a space. It's really something that should be implemented in a very different way. I'm also extremely concerned about a lot of the discussion around this. I think it is, a lot of the discussion around this strikes me as targeted at speech by business owners trying to convey to customers what the costs of government regulation is on their businesses. And so that part of this entire discussion is extremely concerning to me as well. But I think that the more important problem to the entire state of Minnesota's economy is that, like you said, we'll find out whenever a judge tells us what the law actually means. And this kind of a disruption of the entire state, economy of Minnesota, that's a really bad idea. Vote no.
Representative Christie.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Greenman, I do understand what you're trying to do here, and I laud the action, actually, but I think it's very broad. And I tend to concur with what Representative Niska said, that we won't be able to tell you what it means. The courts are going to decide what it means as they fill in the gaps. I was just thinking about some dining experiences that I've had recently. I'm going to keep it within the dining realm. On the menu, you would see things like groups larger than 18% gratuity, which your bill covers in the amendment that was there. You will also see, like on the tab, because of regulation, we're charging a 5% service charge to meet state mandates for safe and sick time and different kinds of things where they're itemizing those. Or if you use your credit card, there's a 2.9% service charge on there. And what we're looking to do is, that particularly in the restaurant business, putting those in an obvious place, which should be on the menu. So I can see the menu itself having one side of the menu talking about all the charges and different things and maybe dietary considerations that people would have and about eating undercooked food and things, some things that they as proprietors want to do to their for their customers to show that they have empathy for their dietary concerns and things. I'm just wondering if we're going to have room anymore on the menu to talk about the food options that people may have to order there once we get all the regulatory things. It's really more of a rhetorical question. I don't need a comment to it, but members, good idea, not ready for prime time. Please vote no.
All right, and we're running a little behind, so we're going to forego closing comments today. I'm going to renew my motion that House File 3438, as amended, be placed on the general register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails, and House File 3438, as amended, is recommended to be placed on the general register. The next item on the agenda today is House File 4182 from Representative Freiberg. Representative Freiberg, when you are up at the front, you can move your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House File 4182 to the State and Local Government Finance and Policy Committee. Is that correct?
State government and local, state and local government finance and policy committees.
Yes. Thank you.
All right. Representative Freiberg moves House File 4182 be re-referred to the state and local government finance and policy committee. Representative Freiberg, move your bill.
Thank you. House File 4182 is the Equal Access to Broadband Act, which will provide digital equity statewide. Franchising agreements for private sector rental of the public right-of-way has a 40-year proven track record of assuring cable TV build-out to all residents and businesses. Franchise agreements also set forth minimum standards of service and hold companies accountable with non-compliance penalties. The Equal Access to Broadband Act will level the playing field with broadband ISPs while assuring build-out and minimum upload and download speeds to meet the current and future needs of the business and residents statewide. Each local government has unique needs for broadband deployment. This bill allows local officials the option to franchise broadband and ISPs in the public right-of-way. As new providers enter or exit the marketplace, physically placing wires and equipment in the public space, local governments bear the cost and the responsibility of managing the scarce public asset for the various users, which can include telecom, cable, gas, electric, and broadband. As an essential service, broadband needs to be accountable at the local level and help pay for local needs and interests. Community television stations across the state rely on cable TV franchise fees and PEG fees to support coverage of government meetings, closed captioning, local news and events, high school sports, election coverage, information and education that allow residents to engage in their communities. This program has become essential with the loss of local newspapers in many markets. While the programs are distributed on many digital platforms, franchise fees are paid only on decreasing traditional cable TV service. Franchising broadband and ISPs would apply the same provisions as cable TV franchise, leveling the playing field. Nothing in the bill prevents the broadband and ISPs choosing to pass through the franchise fee expense to the customer as a line item fee. Most local cable TV providers have been recapturing this business cost for decades. That's sort of a brief summary of the bill and the need for it. Happy to turn it over to testifiers.
All right. Mr. Bradley, did you have a brief comment now, or are you more available for questions?
I'll be available for questions. I will put just a short amount of testimony, if that's okay.
Go ahead, Mr. Bradley. State your name for the record. Sure. Proceed to your testimony.
Thank you, Representative Freiberg, and good afternoon, Chair Stevenson and committee members. My name is Michael Bradley. I'm a partner at the law firm of Bradley Werner, LLC, a firm that represents local governments in telecommunications matters here in Minnesota and throughout the country. Our firm has recently represented Minnesota cities at the FCC supporting the adoption of digital discrimination rules and at the Office of Broadband Development in the development of a meaningful digital opportunity plan. I wanted to address a few concerns that have been raised about House File 4182, the Equal Access to Broadband Act. The first is preemption, and we wanted to assure the committee that there's nothing that preempts local franchising in this bill. There was a U.S. Court of Appeals decision recently that held that broadband can be regulated if consistent with the Federal Cable Act. There's a concern raised about stacking. I'm not sure I completely understand stacking, but the way I'm understanding it's being presented is that there's a claim that multiple layers of government would somehow be able to require a franchise. That's not how franchising works. There's one franchising authority and one franchising authority only. I don't think the bill says anything like that, but if it does, we'll certainly work with Representative Freiberg and the committee and on fixing that. Second, or thirdly, satellite and wireless. Satellite is not included in this bill, primarily because satellite does not use the public rights of way. It's totally wireless. So that would not be included. Under Minnesota statute sections 237.163 subdivision 6D, which is on page 7 of your bill, wireless co-location on government structures is allowed without being required to apply for a franchise. So to the extent that there is a concern raised about wireless companies being subject to franchising, I think that issue is already addressed at state law. And finally, this bill is permissive. There's nothing mandated in this bill, including the requirement of fees. And with that, I will stand for questions.
Wonderful. We're going to take the rest of the testimony first. And just with the last bill, if you two could vacate the podium for a minute, we'll have two people come down at a time. So first we have Dan Rowe, who will be followed by Jody Miller. So if you both could come down and sit at the podium, and then we'll start with Mayor Rowe. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. As you noted, my name is Dan Rowe, and I am in my 14th year serving as mayor of Roseville. For even longer than that, I have represented the city on the North Suburban Communications Commission, or NSCC, which is a municipal joint powers commission that franchises cable operators and operates our community media center for the 9-member cities of our commission, including Arden Hills, Falcon Heights, Lauderdale, Little Canada, Mounds View, New Brighton, North Oaks, and St. Anthony Village. On behalf of the City of Roseville and the NSCC, and concurring with the League of Minnesota Cities, I am pleased to testify in support of HF 4182, the Equal Access to Broadband Act. Through local cable franchising, Minnesota has an established record of protecting consumers and requiring uniform delivery of cable services to residents, providing an important public benefit through community media. We believe that local broadband franchising will replicate that success. Public rights of way are, as was noted earlier, limited and valuable resource that local governments make available to private communications and utility companies to operate their businesses. I can tell you firsthand that the marketplace shift from cable services to broadband services is increasing the burden on public rights of way and thus the value of their use, while at the same time decreasing cable franchise fee revenue to cities. That cable franchise revenue is what funds our franchise regulatory efforts, as well as, importantly, our community media centers. Community media remains a critical public resource, even more so as we experience the decline and disappearance of traditional sources of local news and information. Community media gives our citizens, in many cases, their only access to government activities, local events, including sports and performing arts, and other important local information. While these media offerings are still viewable on cable television through cable franchising, they are now increasingly streamed via broadband providers. The Equal Access to Broadband Act will modernize franchising and allow cities to franchise broadband companies and ensure all of our residents the same benefits with respect to broadband services that they currently receive as a result of cable franchising in Minnesota. The entities that I represent enthusiastically support HF 4182 and ask you to adopt this legislation. Thank you for your leadership in moving this legislation forward and for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Next will be Jody Miller, who will be followed by Brent Christensen.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and Representative Freiberg. Thank you for bringing forth HF 4182. My name is Jody Miller, Executive Director of NDC4 Cable Commission and Town Square Television. I also represent MACTA, a state trade association representing cities, cable commissions, and community television stations across the state. And we are a state chapter of NETOA, a national association that helps us keep our finger on the pulse of broadband, franchising, and PEG programming across the nation. And I will tell you that Minnesota is admired nationally for our strong traditions of broadband, franchising, and PEG programming work. It is my honor to speak on behalf of 135 local PEG stations and the 838 cities who have franchising and some form of local PEG all across the state. By the way, this hearing is being simulcast on local cable channels today, making it accessible to viewers who may not have internet service or a device for streaming. That's today's world. We need to distribute PEG programming on many platforms to reach our residents where they are. and we need to modernize the regulatory and funding structure in order to do this. TST distributes on cable, our website, Vimeo, and Facebook, and other members use YouTube, Hulu, Roku, Apple TV, and many other platforms. But as was mentioned, our funding comes only from traditional cable and is rapidly declining. Peg stations may take many forms. They may be inside a city hall, inside a school or library, or like Town Square Television, an independent nonprofit. The beauty and the challenge is that each local community meets its own unique interests through franchising. NACTA members like me wear many hats. Besides televising about 2,000 hours of local programming last year, we assisted with local broadband efforts, and we took complaint calls from local residents and helped get those resolved through the escalated complaints team at our franchise provider.
And I'll need you to conclude your testimony.
We know that our viewers are watching, and I can tell you in my 35 years in this job, our residents don't mind paying franchise fees when they know their dollars are being employed locally to provide our franchise office and our local programming. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Next, we have Brent Christensen, who will be followed by Tony Mendoza. Mr. Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon, members. For the record, my name is Brent Christensen. I am the president and CEO of the Minnesota Telecom Alliance, or MTA. This year, my members are planning on investing nearly $300 million to expand broadband in Minnesota. However, this bill puts that figure in doubt. I am here to oppose House File 4182. And it's important for the committee to understand that no other state in the country has passed this type of legislation. There was no consultation with the Office of Broadband Development and broadband providers affected by this bill before it was introduced. My members oppose this bill for a variety of technical and policy reasons, but most importantly, because it will increase consumers' bills and harm low-income consumers. The added fee on consumers' bills will tip the affordability scale in the wrong direction. This legislation is contrary to everything that the state of Minnesota, the legislature, the Office of Broadband Development, and my members are doing to see that all Minnesotans have access to quality broadband. You've heard testimonies from the bill that are supporters of the bill that this will bridge the digital divide, allowing local units of government to have build-out requirements as part of their franchises, when in fact it's going to have the opposite effect. Mr. Chairman, members, this legislature established a process long ago to address broadband deployment challenges. For more than 15 years, the Governor's Broadband Task Force has worked to address issues to broadband deployment. Each year, the task force is required to file a report with recommendations to the governor and the legislature. This has worked well, and this bill does an end run around that process that this very body put in place. This bill would create haves and have-nots. Providers will have to make logical business decisions on where to invest their limited capital dollars. Cities that do not have regulatory costs will win out over those that impose additional regulatory burdens. This bill creates an unlevel regulatory playing field for broadband investment at a time when the industry is working hard to get quality broadband to all Minnesotans in an already challenging regulatory environment.
And I'll need to conclude your testimony.
And I'm happy to stand for questions.
Thank you, sir. I signed it. Next, we have Tony Mendoza, who will be followed by Jimmy Francis.
Mr. Mendoza. Mr. Chair, my name is Tony Mendoza. I'm counsel to the Minnesota Cable Communications Association. I'm here to express MCCA's opposition to HF 4182. MCCA's issues with the bill fall into two categories. First, the bill authorizes every level of local government to impose unlimited overlapping franchise fees, taxes, on broadband and broadband-enabled services. Second, the bill would fundamentally change how broadband services are regulated, positioning local governments as the regulator of the future and creating new regulatory schemes for broadband-enabled services. This bill comes as the Biden administration and the FCC are about to issue rules making the FCC the primary broadband regulator. These rules, to be finalized next month, would preempt this bill because it's contrary to a federal policy of ensuring broadband is governed by a national framework. MCCA members must already obtain a cable franchise and pay franchise fees that support public educational and governmental PEG access programming. Federal law caps these franchise fees at 5% of gross revenue from video services, which this bill does not. In 2023 alone, MCCA members paid approximately $45 million in cable franchise and PEG fees to local governments. Pursuant to federal law, franchise fees are passed through to customers. The effect of stacking multiple new franchise fees on top of existing video franchise fees would dramatically increase the cost of every consumer's digital life. The proposed fees are regressive taxes falling heaviest on low-income customers. The bill violates federal laws and FCC rules prohibiting local governments from assessing duplicative franchise fees and from regulating broadband services. And I have to make a point about Mr. Bradley's comment earlier about the Sixth Circuit decision in the city of Eugene. In that case, the Sixth Circuit struck down a broadband franchise. They did not uphold it. The bill's fee provisions also violate the Internet Tax Freedom Act. This bill is touted as the Equal Access to Broadband Act, but the bill would widen the digital divide by erecting new local barriers and increasing the cost of broadband for all customers. Thank you for the opportunity to share MCCA's concerns about this bill.
Thank you. Next is Jimmy Francis, who will be followed by Jeremy Crandell. Mr. Francis.
Mr. Chair, committee members, good afternoon. My name is Jimmy Francis. I'm the mayor of the city of South St. Paul. And in 1982, South St. Paul joined six other cities to form Northern Dakota County Cable Communications Commission, NDC4. South St. Paul enthusiastically supports this House File 4182, and we've entered a resolution of support into the record as well. South St. Paul and all of our seven member cities of NDC4 are committed to ensuring the continued vitality and development of our region through high-capacity broadband. For more than 42 years, we have championed the public interest in cable, telecom, broadband by providing a forum for strategic partnerships. Through our cable TV franchise, we've enabled one of the first robust iNet with partnerships of 12 public entities in 41 buildings, providing a reliable and affordable option when it was not available from the private sector. NDC4 Commission has instituted a full build-out, no redlining or cherry-picking, resulting in the cable company continuing to extend its network to new developments and ensuring that the phone company's 2016 fiber upgrade offered a competitively priced second option for more neighborhoods. Today, local franchising of broadband is needed to ensure that the deployment is not only border-to-border across the state, but also within our communities, especially in light of the millions of dollars that are being distributed. We have provided strong consumer protection, a maximum level of rate regulation allowed. We have expert staff who answer complaints from residents willing to talk about the billing and service problems. These local franchise benefits would be extended to broadband operators who use our public right-of-way. Many of our residents who do not wish to use a chat or a bot to try to call a 1-800 number to somebody overseas. Public education government programming is also very vital to us. And so, in closing, the Equal Access to Broadband Act extends the many benefits of local franchising to our present world, where broadband is an essential service necessary to live, work, play in our community. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Next, we have Jeremy Crandell, who will be followed by Matt Westerhoff. Mr. Crandell.
Mr. Chair, Madam Vice Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeremy Crandell. I'm here on behalf of CTIA, the Trade Association for the Wireless Industry. I want to focus my time today on two points that are highly specific to the wireless industry alone. First, there exists right now a comprehensive federal regulatory construct governing wireless infrastructure deployment in this country and here in the state of Minnesota. It outlines a host of regulations that our industry must adhere to, as well as the very important role of state and local governments as well. Unfortunately, this bill does run headlong into that construct. I want to use one example of a 2018 FCC order that explicitly said that fees charged by localities for wireless infrastructure must be cost-based, saying specifically related to and caused by the deployment itself. And yet this bill does enable localities to require a provider to pay a franchise fee to, quote, raise revenue. I will note the city of Portland sued as it relates to that FCC order on this exact issue in 2020. Ultimately, federal law prevailed. The courts ruled in favor of the federal government, and Portland lost that case. This is just one of a number of examples in this bill that is clearly prohibited by the Federal Communications Act as well as the FCC. There are other specific examples in my written testimony. Setting aside the elements related to federal law, the bill as drafted does have significant state policy implications as well. First, it would make substantial changes to the state's current small cell law in place. It would remove current existing rights that are already in place, and it provides no guardrails on how a franchise designation will ultimately be approved. Finally, this is a critically important point that I want to leave you all with. Current Minnesota law, a state law, already protects the role of localities to oversee and recover costs associated with the management of the rights of way. We believe in terms of the wireless industry. Let's keep in place what is already working. And for these reasons, we oppose House File 4182.
Thank you. Next, we have Matt Westerhoff and then Jeff Tollefson, Councilmember Westerhoff.
Thank you. Honorable Chair Stevenson, distinguished members of the committee, I'm before you today not as just someone with three jobs, but as a citizen concerned about connectivity in the state of Minnesota. My name is Matt Westhoff. I run a IT managed service company called Foundation Technologies. I'm a board member of the Quad Cities Cable Commission, and I serve on the City of Ramsey's Council. These aren't just titles. These are vantage points from which I've witnessed the critical importance and inequities of our broadband infrastructure. Now let's talk about a state that is doing it right. North Dakota. Yes, the best state in the country for gigabit internet is North Dakota, where the internet runs like the Red River, fast and wide, reaching the corners of their state that our current infrastructure can barely dream of. But here we are, debating whether we should step up and allow cities to mitigate the digital redlining in our communities. HF 4182 isn't about mandating how local governments manage their right-of-way. It's about the choice. It's about allowing those of us in the culverts, the city councils, and the local boards to decide if we want to leverage franchise fees to not just pave our streets, but lay down the digital roads of our future. In Ramsey, we face the franchise fee question head-on, only to reassess when the winds changed. The point? We had the choice. This isn't just about beating North Dakota or ensuring our businesses and remote workers aren't left in the digital dust. It's about acknowledging that the internet is as vital as water and electricity these days. It's about recognizing that without action, we risk widening the digital divide, segregating our communities not just by lines on a map, but by their access to information and to opportunity. The issue of funding community television or ensuring our rural areas are not left behind or granting municipalities the autonomy to shape their digital destinies, these are not small concerns. They are indicative of a larger challenge we face when adapting to a world where connectivity is no longer a luxury but a necessity. I thank you for your time. I thank you for your service and consideration of my testimony today.
Thank you, Councilmember Westerhoff. Next, we have Jeff Tollefson. Mr. Tollefson.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Tollefson. I serve as president of the Minnesota Technology Association. Businesses and residents across Minnesota rely on internet access for a number of things: access to education, work opportunities, government services, and so much more. And through the work of the Minnesota Office of Broadband, we've made great strides in our state in closing the digital divide by providing affordable internet access across our state. But passage of this bill could undermine these efforts and set back our state's progress in closing the digital divide. The franchise fees proposed are essentially a tax on Minnesota residents as the extra costs get passed on to consumers through higher monthly bills. This deeply regressive tax would hit low-income Minnesotans the hardest and widen the digital divide for those that have not the resources to absorb the higher costs. If cities truly need to raise revenue to fund public access television, there are more equitable ways to do this that aren't so regressive. Property taxes, for example. And at a time when it's easier and cheaper to live stream city council events, it seems that this is less about recovering costs and more about simply generating extra revenue. There are also significant legal issues involved, as federal law expressly states that local governments have no authority to regulate the entry of mobile service providers, as this is the jurisdiction of the FCC. In addition, franchise fees based on the revenue of a service provider violate an FCC order that such fees must be cost-based. Legality aside, this is not the time for this body to hinder the efforts to advance broadband expansion and digital equity in Minnesota. This bill will divert resources away from the new broadband deployment and increase costs for customers, with a disproportionate impact on low-income families and seniors who do not have flexibility in their budgets.
And I'll need you to conclude your testimony.
For these reasons and more, we urge you to not pass House File 4182 in its current form. Thank you.
All right, members, we are going to go a little over time today. We have clearance to do so. We'll move to member discussion. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Freiberg, invite you back up here. I think it's really cute, your title of this bill, Equal Access to Broadband Act, when in reality it should be labeled the Expensive Access and Bloating Government Act, because that's exactly what this bill does. For you, Representative Freiberg, can you explain to us how, after so much that was put into government budgets over the last biennium, why we would be pursuing a policy and how it would help low-income Minnesotans when you have a bill before us here that provides for unlimited fee increases and overlapping fees that will be passed on to the lowest-income Minnesotans?
Representative Freiberg.
Thank you. I'm glad for the opportunity to respond to that. Our current broadband system actually leaves many of those areas out currently. This act will make sure cities can make sure everybody gets treated equitably. I think some of those areas that they're claiming this would hit financially are those that are least well served by broadband currently, and this bill would make sure that cities can make sure that those areas are treated equitably.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and for everybody, you just heard it's about bloating government. It's about benefiting their budgets. So, Representative Freiberg, can you explain for me, after so many testifiers brought forward PEG programmers, as to why we don't see any specification within your bill to say that these funds would go to fund PEG programmers?
Representative Freiberg.
Yeah, the bill preserves local control to meet community needs, similar to how cable franchising fees are handled. A franchise fee may be used for community television based on local decision making. But as I said, our current franchise model for cable does not actually specify that any specific portion go towards PEG fees. I'd be open to discussions about including a specific percentage or something in there, but at this point the bill is just modeled kind of after the way cable is handled right now.
Can you give me one more follow-up, Representative
Schultz? Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Freiberg. Again, this is about bloating government budgets and a revenue slush fund for local governments here. And so, Representative Freiberg, a lot has been made in testimony given today that there are significant concerns with two different pieces of federal legislation. I get that you might not care about additional lawsuits that may exist because this bill moves forward, but can you express for us how this bill will interact with federal law, specifically the Federal Cable Act and the Internet Tax Freedom Act, which specifically outlines that this is in contention with?
I'm going to let Representative Freiberg respond to that, but I really object to the way that you're discussing Representative Freiberg here, telling him that he might not care about things, mischaracterizing what he said by saying that you heard it right there, he said bloated. Like, let's leave the commentary out of other people's words. Let Representative Freiberg speak for himself, and you can speak for yourself. Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that statement. I think I'd like to turn it over to my testifier for this, since he is a lawyer working in this area.
Absolutely. Mr. Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. Very good questions. Thank you for that question. When we're looking at federal law, we're looking at a couple of different federal laws that were mentioned. The first was a small cell order from the FCC. And as I mentioned in my earlier testimony, we're not talking about small cells or wireless in this bill. We're talking about broadband franchising of wired operators. So that really doesn't apply at all. There was a case mentioned, the city of Portland. that was a case that was litigating the small cell order. Again, not applicable at all to this discussion. My friend Mr. Mendoza mentioned the Sixth Circuit case. I disagree with his representation of that case. I actually was one of the litigators on that case. And that case did not involve overturning a franchise. It involved a license. It involved in part a license fee. So when we're talking about preemption and these types of things, you need to know that we've done our homework on this. And we don't throw preemption lightly around. Let me also just briefly talk about the bloating slush fund thing that you were mentioning. This is the Equal Access to Broadband Act, and through franchising, local governments will be able to make sure that all of their residents are served with the same level of quality of service across their entire footprint. Let me give you an example of how this works and how it doesn't work, okay? When we look at cable franchising, local governments, right now are able to franchise cable operators. And through that process, local governments made sure that every resident in their city was served with the same level of service across the board. Now, let me give you another example where local franchising is not allowed, and that's in the telephone business. Okay? With telephone, you have very uneven service across footprints all over the state, including the metro. Let me give you another example. When a phone company came and wanted to provide cable service for the first time in the metro area, they had to, for the first time, get a franchise from a local government. And the local government required, starting with the city of Minneapolis, but followed by every city in the metro area, they required the phone operator to equitably build out their entire city over a reasonable period of time, just like they did with cable, by the way. And that was the very first time in 100 years of regulation of phone companies, not through franchising, through other means. That was the first time ever that they were required to equitably build out an entire city. So when we're talking about this bill, this is the Equal Access to Broadband bill. And if you want to be serious about making sure that all residents across the state of Minnesota, and particularly every city in the state of Minnesota, if you want to make sure that they all have equal access to broadband, this bill should be supported.
Okay, we have one more member on the list. I'm going to let Representative Niska speak, and then we're going to vote on this bill, and then we're going to take testimony. There's just two people who signed up. I want them to get a chance to speak since they're here today, and we'll lay over the last bill on the agenda. Representative Niska, if you can be brief, I would appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I will resist the temptation to dive into Federal Circuit case law with the testifier. I just want to make a brief comment, which is I think it's important to contrast Representative Freiberg's answers about local control, the uncapped tax we're creating here, and the lack of any limit or even policy direction beyond the nice title in this bill about what local cities are going to do about it. And to contrast this bill that we're looking at right now with the bill we just looked at about trying to limit junk fees, telling businesses that they can't use deceptive pricing in their bills that they pass. What this bill would properly be, I think, labeled would be the junk local tax bill. What this bill does is it creates an unlimited, uncapped, unrestricted new source of revenue for local governments. And I certainly can appreciate why local officials would support a new way to raise revenue in a way that's less transparent, that's on every customer's monthly cable bill, where they wouldn't necessarily expect to see a local tax, instead of funding local government through the property taxes, which local government officials are very easily held accountable for. So I think that this is a bad direction to go in. I appreciate my friend from Ramsey who testified about a disagreement we had in Ramsey about a franchise fee. But what this really is a new, different way to tax people in by city governments, especially in a way that the city government officials are going to be held less accountable for. So I think this is a really bad idea. I hope we reject it. And Mr. Chair, I request a roll call.
All right. There will be a roll call. Representative Freiberg renews his motion that House File 4182 be re-referred to the State and Local Government Finance Committee. Mr. Durfee will take the roll. The chair votes aye.
Chair Stevenson, aye. Vice Chair Katoza-Watoon?
Aye.
Vice Chair Katoza-Watoon, aye. Lito Driscoll?
No.
Lito Driscoll, no. Representative Bierman?
Bierman, aye.
Bierman, aye. Representative Cha?
Aye.
Cha, aye. Representative Dotseth?
Dotseth, no.
Dotseth, no. Representative Freiberg?
Aye.
Representative Freiberg, aye. Representative Cleborn?
Aye.
Cleborn, aye. Representative Kegel?
Aye.
Kegel, aye. Representative Kraft?
Aye.
Kraft, aye. Representative Liebling?
Aye.
Liebling, aye. Representative New Brindley? And I hear Representative Niska?
No.
Niska, no. Representative Perryman?
Perryman, no.
Perryman, no. Representative Farr?
Farr, no.
Farr, no. Representative Schultz?
Schultz, no.
Schultz, no. Representative Tabke?
Yes.
Tabke, yes.
With 10 ayes and 6 nays, the motion does prevail, and House File 4182 is recommended to be referred to the State and Local Government Finance and Policy Committee. Thank you, Representative Freiberg. The last bill on our agenda is House File 4396, and we will move that before the committee. It will be laid over today, but there is an A1 amendment that I think we can quickly adopt just to get the bill in the shape that the committee...
Please, Mr. Chair.
All right. Any discussion to that A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A1 say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. A1 is adopted. Representative Liebling, if you give us just a brief thumbnail sketch of the bill and then we'll...
All right. Thanks, Mr. Chair. It's a good day for me to let my testifier do that since I can hardly talk.
Absolutely. We have Marnie Falk. Ms. Falk.
Hi. Chair Stevenson, members of the committee. My name is Marnie Falk, and I'm the Director of Public Policy at Gillette Children's. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and thank you, Chair Liebling, for authoring this legislation. Gillette Children's is a nonprofit, former state hospital, established by the legislature in 1897 as the nation's first public hospital for children who have disabilities. We serve children with complex disabilities, rare conditions, and traumatic injuries. In 2022, we saw patients from all 87 Minnesota counties, 41 U.S. states, and 6 international countries. In 1994, the Minnesota legislature established essential community providers. This designation is a recognition that healthcare providers that serve, per the statutory language, high-risk, special needs, and underserved individuals are essential to those they serve, and that health insurance networks should not limit access to these providers. This is not currently happening in all cases. This legislation clarifies current law to ensure essential community providers are given the opportunity to be included in all state-regulated products offered by a health plan and that they are paid a reasonable rate within these networks. We have been working with Chair Liebling, state agencies, and stakeholders on the right language to provide clarity and look forward to continuing those conversations as this bill moves through the process. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. We also do have Dan Andreessen signed up to testify. Mr. Andreessen.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dan Andreessen with the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. Just want to get on the record that we are looking into the situation that was outlined by proponents. This is something that was brought to our attention just this past Thursday. So we're talking with our members about this. Looking at the language, it's not quite clear if we're just clarifying or expanding existing law, especially with the language in the A1, so I think we need to keep talking about that one. If it's interpreted as an expansion, I think we'd want to caution the legislature about getting involved. Picking one side or the other, because what this is a negotiation between two parties, insurer and the provider, especially when we get down to reimbursement. And reimbursement is what the patient is paying at the end of the day. Just want to get on the record, we are talking with proponents about it. Mr. Chair, thank you.
All right, thank you, Mr. Andreessen. And we do have just a couple minutes here if people want to discuss it, member discussion to the bill. We are laying it over, but any discussion? Representative Driscoll.
I'm just wondering if you're going to ask if the public has any testimony today.
Is there any member of the public who wishes to testify as to this bill? Seeing none. I don't know. Is there any discussion to the bill?
Yeah, Mr. Chair. So if
Representative Liebling.
Since there's no discussion, maybe we could just move this to HFP and then because we are going to continue to discuss it, the parties. The issue about reimbursement, I think, can properly be dealt with in the Health Finance and Policy Committee, and that is kind of the only real issue here. So, believe me, we won't just move it to, we won't try to pass it without working that out or anything like that.
The only question I was asked if Mr. Andreessen could come back and if he's okay with moving it out of here, and just on the timeline on here, and the stops we have to be able to continue to work on it.
Mr. Andreessen, I don't know if you have a comment on that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Driscoll, I guess it's, I don't have the election certificate, so I guess it's your prerogative. We are committed to working with proponents. Again, we just heard about this, so we're still diving into it. So I can't really say much more than what I've said in my testimony.
The only thing that I would say is that if we do get provisions that are amended or the bill changes, then there are commerce provisions that we bring it back in here for discussion. I'll stipulate you can move it out. Unless it changes dramatically and it's within our jurisdiction.
All right. I will, Representative Liebling, I moved to bring it before the committee, even though it's your bill. I will move, adjust my motion to re-refer it to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee and renew that motion as amended. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and House File 4396, as amended, is recommended to be re-referred to Health, Finance, and Policy.
Thank you very much.
And with that, the meeting is adjourned.